遺伝って何つったっけ、遺伝、遺伝情報。あ、information contained in a kind of DNA、of a, some kind of bacteria first、to search for any curious pattern、which might have been、sent from the extraterrestrial intelligence. I do not go into deep into this, and so whoever is interested, please take this up.
I'm afraid you've also added one more parameter to the number of parameters that have to be searched for signals. It looks like even if there's no detectable signal the first time you look at your data, you just put it away for a while. So this small change in the program, the next speaker stands on the left seat. Well, the same subject on the very low frequency study search.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chair, I would like to say something about another possibility which before we had detected and is still a viable proposition. The idea is that we do have such a multi-dimensional haystack that we want to diminish the amount of possibilities, and one of the ways of doing it would probably be going to very low frequencies. If we go take our equipment out of the Earth and go into space, then we can benefit from the very low frequencies. But the idea is such that we will use very simple equipment because we can't carry extensive structures out in space. It's well, at least it's very expensive. The idea is based on the single dipole. Imagine what would happen if we carry out a dipole that is detonant at, say, 1 kHz. Well, its collecting area is enormous because it will have very nearly 10 to the 10 square meters, which is about 100,000 times more than the other sphere dish. And the weight of a dipole like that may be of the order of a few hundred kilograms only. Well, this is one of the great things. Now we also have a look at the spectrum. So that is the galactic background and extragalactic background. And if we go into our frequencies, well, one has to start somewhere. The assumption that I make, well, they are not exact, but approximate. Just to simplify calculations, is that, let's say, 1 megahertz, we get about 1 million degrees K temperature. And it should go down, effectively vanish at zero frequency. Which means that, taking this assumption, the noise is growing proportionately to frequency. Temperature is growing proportionally to frequency, say, but if 1 megahertz, we will have 100 degrees, at 1 kilohertz, we will have 1,000 degrees. Now let's see if we put 1 megawatt transmitter on a spacecraft, well, the other side will do it. Initially, it will be difficult for us. Let's see what we can do. At a distance of 10 light years, if we have a signal to noise ratio at 1 kHz of 7, well, very nearly 10 to 1. So the signal would be visible right away without any, I repeat, any search. It would just stick up above the noise by a factor of the signal to noise ratio of 10 to 1. There's a snag though, and the problem is that at 1 kHz, if you take the density of reference in the search, space, then you end up with frequencies, the critical frequencies that are all the order of several, well, about 1 kHz. So So the point is, we must stick to the dipole and not give way to going to higher frequencies because of Earth. Be nice, close up. But then if you stick to this dipole, say 150 kilometers long, or halfway dipole at 1 kHz, then we retain this tremendous collective era. By doing that, even if we start now extract the dipole at higher frequencies, it will just become a long dipole and will have multiple lobes, which really do not matter. One, another important thing worth noting here is that it is very nearly an isotropic radiator. So the problem of searching for the direction very nearly vanishes. So besides even the around the axis of the dipole, due to the interstellar and the coronal scattering, you will have the radar wave scattered, so practically the dipole will be omnidirectional. So I think this is one example that we should still consider trying to think along these lines. And if we, for instance, have a frequency that is not, say, 1 kHz, I will not, due to the shortage of time, I will not go into more details, but it is obviously disadvantageous to go higher in frequency and going lower in frequency because the interstellar space filled with electrons will not let the waves through, just like the atmosphere. And then if we say, for instance, assume that these are not sine waves but square waves, which are relatively easy to produce, then they will have harmonics. And because the signal to noise ratio may be not too bad, then we could not only see the basic but also the harmonics as well. Well, because of the limited time, this is just about all that I'd like to say now. And I have some more detailed calculations, and I'll be glad to discuss some of the problems that come through in one's mind.
Yes, I agree. But one of the things that I did not mention is that we go way out of the solar system, not only at Earth orbit. So we go on one of the missions that leaves the solar system. And then we could use also the, some sort of solar sail to stretch the dipole because it will be accelerated. We can, for instance, make a mission any time from Jupiter from the other side of the solar system that gives you several astronomical units.
Well, even if you do that, I don't think any low density platform that has instabilities is likely to radiate greatly in its frequency. And that may.
Yes, yes. Well, I quite agree. This is just a suggestion. I'm not positive that I have to take a dipole of
one. The next paper, in fact, is on this subject. Shoe on the other foot. If we were out in space and asked the question whether or not we would see finding intelligent life on Jarrett's radio mission, Woody Sullivan had his eavesdropping radio signature of Earth.
Well, there are many questions associated with CD, of course, and I'd like, in a way, to address the question of what kind of message might we receive and how should this influence our search technique. And there are two basic assumptions you can make of CD, in some sense, and there's been an implicit assumption throughout this session this afternoon that any signals are going to be purposeful. However, I would like to bring up the possibility that civilizations may be detected inadvertently, not through a purposeful signal, but either through interception of signals between different civilizations or through leakage from another civilization. Now, which is the better bet, either between purposeful or eavesdropping, as we call it, depends on many characteristics of the signal, its strength, and its bandwidth and other properties. It depends on the longevity of such signals that the civilization either leaks or purposely sends out. And the latter is the key unknown, which has not been discussed this afternoon because the session was not directed that way. But since it is unknown, we should examine both possibilities equally well. And going further, we should perhaps take the Socratic point of view and know thyself first to get some guidance as to what strategies we might take in looking for other civilizations. And so let's take a look at what indeed the Earth is leaking, because in fact we have only sent out purposeful signals for 2 minutes from Arecibo a few years ago, whereas we've been leaking rather heavily now for 25, 30 years. What I want to investigate is what is the most detectable and information-laden radio service on the Earth which escapes from the atmosphere and ionosphere of the Earth. And I'm going to have to go very quickly through this due to the lack of time, but it turns out that what you want is the service which will give you the maximum power density per unit bandwidth per unit steradian, however, not too concentrated in space, such as an Arecibo radar beam, because that only illuminates a very small fraction of skies. You want it to be reasonably powerful per steradian and yet cover a large fraction of the sky. And so we need to look into the transmitter powers, the gains of the antennas, and the effective bandwidth. Now, if we look at the bandwidth, that gets to be a very complicated subject, but if we look at the first slide, here is one obvious consideration. Namely, is it AM or FM? And it turns out that in FM transmission, you have thousands of sidebands, and greater than or around 90% of the power is usually in these sidebands, at least for FM broadcasting. Whereas in AM broadcasting, about 50 to 100% of the power is in the carrier, which often has a very narrow width of less than or around 1 hertz. Now, these are logarithmic scales, and they don't show it as well as I'd like to, but nevertheless, quite a bit of analysis and some observation has shown that, in fact, AM broadcasting, in this case it's a television video carrier, does indeed have the great majority of the total power right in that narrow 1 hertz width, not spread out over the 5 megahertz. That's a very small fraction of the power that's spread out. So if we examine all of the radio services, not just broadcasting, the next slide shows you a table of some of the ones that were considered. We considered many more. In the United States, we're very oriented towards citizens band radio. There are 10 million of these pickup trucks going around the U.S. But each one is only a few watts. They're not on most of the time, and most of it doesn't get out of the ionosphere anyway. If we look into weather and marine air radars, they are indeed quite powerful. However, they are very highly pulsed, only maybe a microsecond typically. Therefore, the bandwidth is in megahertz. Therefore, the detectability is very low. BMUs type radars refers to the ballistic missile early warning system, which the United States maintains in northern latitudes, and presumably the Soviets have a similar version looking back at us. And this operates at about 400 megahertz, tremendous power. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant the point. Tremendous amount of power in the transmitter, and they also are reasonably directed, so the effective radiating power is very high. They use long pulses of a millisecond long for radar, and therefore the bandwidth is only at kilohertz, and you get a very high power per hertz. And then FM and TV broadcasting down the bottom. FM broadcasting, for the reasons I mentioned, is not so powerful as TV. The video carrier is AM and TV. The audio, of course, is FM, but it's only 10% of the power of the video carrier. And it turns out that in terms of the number of transmitters and the information content in the transmitters, that TV broadcasting, in our opinion, is the winner. I should mention this is work done with Chris Wethow and Stuart Brown. So we focus in on TV broadcasting, remembering that the BMUs type radars are still much more detectable. However, we feel they will not be as useful because, for instance, the military is constantly jumping around in frequency to avoid being jammed. And as you will see, a lot of the information that you can get from the TV video carriers is from the Doppler shifts. And this would be very disconcerting and frustrating to the extraterrestrial eavesdropper also. Also, the bandwidth of kilohertz makes it that much more difficult to measure precise Doppler shifts. Since publishing a paper on this, I've learned about yet a more powerful radar than the BMUs. The U.S. Navy operates one in Texas that is for monitoring satellites, This turns out to be at 200 megahertz, and it has an effective radiated power of 10 to the 11th watts that goes into now only a tenth of a hertz, because it's a CW bistatic radar. And so this turns out to be detectable at distances about 3 times greater than even the ballistic missile early warning system. But now if we focus on TV, the next slide shows you a typical TV spectrum where you have the audio and the video carriers, and then if you go down to more dynamic range, you see the color subcarriers and all sorts of sidebands scattered through here, but these are way down in terms of the power, so we'll just focus and model a TV station as simply a video carrier. What we did was there are 15,000 TV transmitters in the world. We didn't feel like punching up 15,000 cars, so we limited it to 2,000 most powerful, which in fact have 97% of all of the broadcast power. This turns out to be greater than 50 kilowatts. And we end up then with 2,200 stations that are in our model. And the distribution of the stations on the Earth is rather interesting. As you can see, it's hardly random. There are 46% in North America, 29% in Europe, and the rest scattered around. I should give Japan credit for being third place there. We have no information in Soviet Union or China. However, we don't think that this really invalidates the model very much. The Soviet Union amount of broadcasting is probably similar to a large European country. In China, there is virtually nothing. So what we did was to now study the locations of each of these, put an antenna pattern onto each transmitter. Well, here, this shows you what frequencies they're at in the three broadcast bands. Through here, you can see that most of the effective radiated power is in UHF, simply because it's a higher frequency. And here is a typical transmitting RCA super turnstile antenna. Now, what sort of beam widths do we have? We look at theoretical beam widths as well as measured ones. And this is our model beam width for the three different bands. It turns out that the antenna patterns were quite constant from country to country and from one frequency to another. And so we felt we could model it with the three model antenna patterns. These are taking into account reflection off the Earth. That's what causes this secondary hump, especially at UHF, where we've also put a little bit of tilt in, as is usually done. And so now you take this antenna pattern, and you put that at the location of each of the antennas that you saw, put it onto a tower, put in refraction for the Earth and for the atmosphere, and you spin the Earth, and you say, what would it look like from Barnard's star, which is at pretty near an equatorial location. This shows how Barnard's star has moved over a period of 22 years. It's very near to us. And if they were looking from that location, this is the picture of the Earth that they would see if they could resolve the Earth. Now, I'm not assuming that in any way, but this is just instructive. Can we have the lights off in the hallway, please? And you see it's a little brightened Earth, because broadcasting, of course, is along the horizon very close, so you don't want to send your advertising dollars straight overhead. And so you broadcast along the horizon, and whenever North America or Western Europe comes around the edge of the Earth, you will get blasted. However, when they are directly below you, you won't see very much. And obviously it's going to depend on what declination you're at. And here is what the view that they would have, just measuring flux density. Depending on the bandwidth they have, of course, this will influence what the scale is here. This is arbitrary the way I have it now. But you see, as a function of Greenwich sidereal time over the period of the Earth, you get these strong peaks due to, you can even resolve the west coast and the east coast of the U.S. And you see the U.S. coming around on one side and then setting on the other. And so each concentration of stations will in fact give you two peaks. And so you get blasted 4 times a day, and you get minor blasts from Australia and Japan. They're even discernible in here. Now, if we look at some other declinations, a southern star will not be seeing as much because it will not get above the horizon even for northern Europe. And it also will stay longer in the beam because it stays near the horizon. And the associated rises and sets for Western Europe, for instance, are much closer together than for the Barnard star. If we look at the northern star, now, in fact, we don't see the pair phenomenon I mentioned, the rising and setting, because the star is so far north it never gets down near the southern horizon, and you get it during lower culmination, as astronomers say, in the northern sky. And so this is when North America is coming around to the opposite side of the Earth, as seen from this northern star in declination of plus 60 degrees. Well, this shows you the sort of modulations that you get in time. of course, the great amount of information will come from frequency tracking, because these are very narrow band signals, and as an example, I've tried to find the most crowded portion of the spectrum, and here are all the channel 3s in the United States, actually channel 3 plus, because they're set off in three different frequencies, and I think this is about as crowded as you get, and here's the frequency structure that you would get over four times during one day, and as seen from that northern star, and these now are actual flux densities that you would have if you had an appropriately matched filter on the order of a tenth of a hertz wide. That's the order of the crystal stability in the typical television transmitters. Now you see that you do get a little bit of crowding, but in fact you never get enough crowding that is desirable to open up your receiving bandwidth. So the problem of detecting the Earth, in fact, is identical to the problem of detecting the strongest station on the Earth. Now, if we plug in some parameters to try to get some idea about ranges at which this can be detected, we've already seen the relevant formulas, and I'll now take an Arecibo antenna, and of course one disadvantage of this idea is that we are down where the galactic background is creating a lot of noise, and so the UHF broadcasting will be advantageous. We find that for an integration time of 10 minutes, which is the amount of time it takes the star to rise to the beam, that the typical, not the typical, the strongest UHF station, about 5 megawatts, would be detectable only a distance of 2 light years. It's only halfway to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri. That's rather discouraging. However, if you now say what distance would the ballistic missile early warning system be detectable at, that's 20 light years. And the Navy radar in Texas is 60 light years. And if we get a little bit more optimistic and say, what about a Cyclops array? It turns out that it increases all the ranges by about a factor of 10. And so the most optimistic then is this Navy radar with a Cyclops type array can be detected at 600 light years, which is encompassing 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 7th stars. However, it's of course only been on the air for 10 years, and so it'll take until the 26th century before all of them have had their chance. Now, what about if we look at these radio signature as a function of time? Here is time, a node dominating 1940 to 1975. Here is the television transmitter power. You see it's risen very remarkably. And so, in fact, the Earth has become an extremely bright place on a cosmologically infinitesimal time. And so this waveform, this bubble, is moving out, taking in more and more stars. Now, what about program material? Obviously, you must be thinking, well, if this is television, all the information content must be tremendous, but remember, I'm only talking about detecting the video carrier. If you open up the bandwidth to take in the total 5 megahertz, so you can get the picture, in more ways than one, you then need 20,000 times greater sensitivity. And perhaps they have that, but obviously that really hurts your ranges. One can look upon this either as extremely discouraging or very reassuring, that in fact, they're not able to get any of the picture information. But just from the video carrier, you can get a tremendous amount of scientific deductions. You can get the orbital rate of the Earth very simply. It's exactly what astronomers call a single-line spectroscopic binary. And you can get all the orbital parameters of the Earth. We make arguments, which I don't have time to go into, that in fact one will be able to derive the mass of the Earth. You certainly can get the size of the Earth from the Doppler shifts and from the rotation period. You can get a complete map, like you saw in that slide, from techniques very similar to what radar astronomers use, namely studying all of these stations in terms of their time between appearance on one limb and appearance on the other limb, and their Doppler shifts. You can determine their longitude and latitude. You can make the complete map and try to deduce from that whatever you will. You can deduce it as a planet, if you think that people don't live at least on black dwarfs or something like that, such high gravities. You can also even determine something about the engineering structure of these things, because you have the size of the antenna beams from the amount of time that it takes to sweep one station to sweep through. So you have its beam width, you know its frequency, you assume that it's a diffraction limit aperture, you have the 15 meter size of a television antenna at interstellar distances, thereby telling you things about engineering on planet Earth. Cultural deductions, obviously one can speculate at great length here. It's a little bit like an archaeologist who has knowledge of only of a city's street plan, looking at that map of stations, and he has to deduce everything about the culture. I think there's quite a bit that one could deduce, although obviously it's speculative. For instance, just as an example, the frequency conventions, of course, are very different amongst groups of countries. And you could thereby perhaps say, well, this is obviously people that are associated with each other in some sense. And in fact, that's exactly right. But then you might be puzzled why some little island in one corner has the same frequency convention as this big island down here. I'm talking about Great Britain and Australia. But in any case, that is giving you clues. So now, to sum up as to what this means that we should do, should we eavesdrop, I would say that the relative longevity of leaking signals versus purposeful ones is a complete unknown. So that is hard to argue either way. The information content, with a purposeful signal, you require a code. Not just the evidence that something is there will be easy, but then real information may be tricky. Whereas you see here, with standard scientific methods, you can deduce one hell of a lot of information. The third thing, range, is disadvantageous to eavesdropping, at least if our planet is least detectable, because obviously if you have dedicated antennas looking at each other, you can communicate at much greater distances. But for all we know, other civilizations may be leaking prodigious amounts compared to ourselves, if they live on larger planets or whatever. Also, another point is that this is not just applicable to television broadcasting, it's applicable to any narrow band signals that they might in fact be using. Maybe they use narrow band infrared for their communications for one reason or another. So perhaps we should try some eavesdropping. This obviously means we should perhaps look at lower frequencies, because it's a matter of whether, since it's not purposeful, it's a matter of whether the leaking radiation is going up faster than the galactic background to see whether the signal to noise is going to improve. And also, we should look for very narrow bandwidth, so that's not different from the purposeful strategy. We should also look for drifting signals, because of course they are not trying to stabilize their LOs relative to their Doppler drifts. And along this line, Steve Knowles of NRL and I are going to try to do some eavesdropping on Barnard Star and Altair at Arecibo. Obviously, we have no idea what frequencies to look at. It's a real wild shot, but we feel like we should try it. And so in summary, I think we should try both strategies in CD and pay attention to the only civilization which we do know something about, which is blasting out both television and the military, and that is our own. Thank you.
You have to like to guess CC.
Along the same lines, I think we have in like a more advanced civilization would still persist in use of carriers. And in fact, as modulation coding schemes become more advanced, they look more and more like noise and hence have less and less of a signature.
Yeah, this is very true. But of course, we had no idea what's going to happen on scales of centuries and millennia in technology. On a scale of a couple of decades, the cable TV people have been telling us in the United States it was going to take over within 5 years, in the last 25 years. And who knows what economics applies to other planets that have entirely different...
But it's not a matter of economics, it's a matter of spectrum space. Even if the cable system is more expensive, ultimately, you have to have it. You're just not moving.
Have you looked at satellite uplinks? Because in the future, we're going to saturate the...
Yes, they're usually FM. They're usually quite broadband.
Well, and they have carriers.
Yeah, but the carrier in FM is way down, the time average, relative to the total amount of transmitter power. However, if the solar energy gathering satellite blasting down to Earth and receiving antenna, only a small fraction of that reflects back, which it certainly will, just for spillover and nothing else. That turns out to be a rather strong spike, which instead of going along the horizon, it goes straight up.
The U.S. has an advantage of, for instance, Eastern Europe, because you have AM for television. Eastern Europe has FM.
Has FM for the video carrier?
Yes.
No.
For the video carrier, for audio.
Yes, well, that's true in most countries except Great Britain.
But
I'm talking about a video carrier only. It's AM almost everywhere in the world.
Okay, we have to get out of here. There's another meeting. In a really advanced civilization, they probably wouldn't be broadcasting at all. The entire spectrum would be reserved. People could do radio astronomy. coming up at 5 o'clock in order to all threaten that direction. Thank you for coming back to the
That's the end of the session on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence held at the IRSI General Assembly in Helsinki on 2nd August 1978.